Welcome back to the program. We live in a world often between the mundane and the absurd, except that sometimes it's hard to tell which is which. My guest today, George Saunders, and his brilliant short stories helps us all to navigate that landscape, whether it's the talons of corporate culture, the underside of capitalism, or simply the way we treat each other. Saunders finds the poetry that allows us to see the truth in a well-crafted sentence. George Saunders is the undisputed master of the short story. He's the author of 6 previous books, a MacArthur Genius Fellow. He writes regularly for The New Yorker and Harper's and teaches at Syracuse University. The New York Times said about his current collection of stories the 10th of December that it's the best book you will read this year. It is my pleasure to welcome George Saunders to the program today to talk about the 10th of December. George Saunders, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. I just wish you would continue in that vein for another 15 minutes. It was very enjoyable.
Well, thank you. It's good to have you. You have an engineering background. You were an engineer before you were a writer of short stories or anything else. In many ways, when one thinks about short stories being so beautifully crafted, particularly yours, there is almost an engineering quality to them.
Yes. You know, I went to the School of Mines in Colorado, and the thing I learned there was rigor. You know, they were very merciless about, they were very happy to flunk you out if you showed weakness. And they had a mantra, which was no partial credit. You know, so if you worked through a problem and the answer was wrong, that was a zero, which turned out to be pretty good training for story writing, because it's a wonderful form, but it's very strict, you know. And if you have done 97 drafts and the story still isn't working, there's no partial credit. So in some ways, that rigor was really, really helpful.
Talk about that in crafting a short story and in being able, in some respects, much more than a novel, let's say, to kind of see the whole thing at once. When it's 8, yeah, 9, 12 pages, it's different than when it's 300 pages.
That's a very, very terrific point. And it's actually what I love about it is you can be a control freak, and you sort of have to be a control freak. And, I read somewhere that, or actually the writer Linda Barry talks about this, that when you get done with a story, it's the neurological response is very similar to getting done with a joke. There's kind of that split-second reevaluation for efficiency of form. So what's wonderful for a kind of, you know, control freak like myself is you can go through the things hundreds, thousands of times, just micro-adjusting for nuance. And your goal, as you're implying, is to get it to be the sort of perfect platonic version of itself where every step is intentional. And at the end, you sort of know just where the reader is. And it's kind of a really exciting but potentially, you know, obsessive kind of a process.
When you do that, though, over and over again and repeat it as you go over these stories, do you lose sight of what you want or what you think the response, the emotional response is going to be?
Well, yeah, and, you know, actually, that's sort of the point, because if you come in, you know, you come in knowing what you want to do. If you actually do that, you sort of failed. You know, kind of like if you went on a date and your plan was to have a good date and to have this conversation and impress her with this part of yourself, that's going to be a boring date because you're condescending. But if you go in sort of with a, you know, good intention and willing to have the story talk back to you and direct you, then it gets really exciting. So part of the thing is to go in with a strong plan, but be very willing to have it overturned as the story's energy asserts itself. And to me, that's the kind of exciting part, is that you have to relinquish control while at the same time taking it back in other ways. So it's a really, really interesting mental process.
Talk about it from the point of view of the energy of that prose, because in many ways it's counterintuitive. One would think that the more you're refining, the more you're doing, that in fact you would lose some of the energy. But in your work, in each and every stage, it increases the energy of that prose.
Well, thanks. Well, you know, I think of it, I played music badly when I was younger, but I did a little bit of recording. So I think writing is sort of like that, where you go in on a given day and you're hoping to do some wild, spontaneous improvisation with which you surprise yourself. If you do, you save that bit. But if adjacent to that is a part that's dead or, as you say, overworked, then you just say, okay, I'm scrapping that and I'm going to improv another day. So in the best case, a story, you know, that I might work on for a couple of years, if you could actually sort of trace the origins of it, there would be a series of spontaneous improvisations that I kept. And I kept them because they served the form of the thing. So it's a wonderful kind of way of having it, you know, having it both ways. You can be strict and controlling and refining, and you can also be totally spontaneous. And in the end, you're the guy who chooses, you know, which bit gets to remain.
Is there a stronger emotional response, a more passionate response to a short story? I mean, is it like an affair as opposed to a long marriage in some respects?
I think so, and I think it's, and for me, you know, I'm from the South Side of Chicago, and when we were kids, everything, every big emotion came in the form of a joke or a tease or something like that. So I love the idea that a story is joke-like in its form. In this sense, you know, if you say, a duck walked into a bar, well, okay, we know that in 2 minutes we better be laughing or else you're slightly embarrassed. The story is very similar. You know, you've got 8 pages, and anyone who reads stories knows that there's supposed to be something kind of crazy and wonderful and transformative that happens at the end. And if it doesn't, there's that kind of same, you know, crickets and sound at the end of a joke. So it's kind of high risk in that way. And I think also for me, I don't know, but the moments of my life that have been major and transformative, they feel more like a story than a novel. There, you know, some kind of submerged meaning pops up or you suddenly realize something. So for me, the story feels more like life than novels generally do.
Because in a sense, so much of life, and it's certainly true for so many of the characters in your stories, it is about those moments. There are so many moments that define us, and that in that moment, it is almost like a whole story because things come into focus so profoundly.
Exactly. And you know what I love about a story, and it's in novels too, but it's a very human movement where our first movement is to caricature somebody and judge them. You know, you see somebody in the street, oh, I know that guy, or somebody has an opposing political view or whatever. The first human move is to sort of go, ah, I know you, get thee behind me, or I love you, whatever. But then the more interesting move is when you take a couple steps closer to that person or that character, and you start to kind of look a little more closely. Is this person more like me than I might have imagined? Is there some way that his totally unreasonable position under scrutiny starts to seem actually quite reasonable? And so one of the reasons I love to work on stories for months and years is that often you'll start with an idea of a character that's sort of dismissive or condescending, but the form itself won't let you stay there. You have to keep looking and looking every day, and you gradually come to kind of love this person that at the beginning you were ready to give a kick, you know? So that's a wonderful thing that fiction, I think both reading and writing, helps you to do. I've become kind of addicted to that progression.
In many ways, it is a finer tuning of the old idea of the political being personal, that it's really only in the human connection that we understand the political at all.
Exactly right. And in fact, you know, in that human mode, we're actually quite capable of maintaining multiple and contradictory viewpoints. But when we slide into this kind of politicizing, then we feel like we're not really human unless we're judging harshly. But I in fiction, sometimes, you know, you get to this place where so many things are simultaneously true about the character, and there's that kind of sacred moment where instead of choosing one, you're just sitting there, like, yep, that's true about him, that's terrible, that's true about him, that's wonderful. And so for me, the kind of big payoff in the process of writing is when I get the story to a place where all those simultaneous contradictory truths are just sort of resonating, and at that point you just step out of the room. You know, something I think Fitzgerald said, you know, that mark of intelligence is to be able to hold two contradictory views at one time. And in fiction, you can sometimes have all 20. You know, you can have a close approximation of an actual human being who is, of course, so full of those contradictions. And the magic moment is in the story, you really don't have to judge. You can just almost like all these spinning plates, and then you just go have dinner.
And the poetry of that, I suppose, is that that's how life actually is. That is how our relationships actually are.
I think so. I think if you, you know, there's some quote about it, if you could inhabit the mind of your enemy or at his lowest point, you would have no enemies. So I think that if you could really, really understand life, it would be, you know, 10 million contradictions and ambiguities. And then maybe you'd have, you know, this sort of godlike point of view would be to just hover above it and kind of love it, you know, enjoy it.
One of the things I know you've talked about is that in this collection, in the 10th of December, that in many ways it is slightly more optimistic, that it is that you were looking for more of the positive in your stories.
Funny, because I say that, and then I read them like at bookstores, and I'm like, ooh, that's pretty dark still. So I think there was a slight movement, I mean, just in maturing, I'm 54, and at the stage of life where our kids have gone off and are doing well. And so I think there was just a feeling that if you imagine a story as kind of a compressed scale model of life, say, then there ought to be a place in that model for some of the redemptive valences, I guess you could say, or just the moments where people actually do the right thing, which in real life you see it all the time. And so I think partly that's technical. It's harder, I think, to do that. It's harder to portray positive action and positive emotion because there's the danger of that cliff called sentiment. But it's kind of my resolution as I continue is just to try to get a more true, beautiful balance of the way that people behave well and the way that people behave badly without schmaltzing it up at all. You know, not making the world more negative and sinister than it is, but also not making it more, you know, sort of positive and radiant than it is. Just to sort of find a balance between those two.
How hard is it to find that balance between emotional response and sentimentality?
It's very hard. It's a very, you know, and it's a character test because, you know, sentiment is just unearned emotion. So in a story is a great vehicle for getting emotion that's not earned because some of the, at certain times, linguistic vitality can lead a reader to experience fake emotion. So for me, that's a real, you put your finger on a very important aesthetic principle for me, which is to be sure that when you get the emotion, you've earned it honestly, and you haven't just sort of summed it up with verbal pyrotechnics.
One of the things you mentioned before is that you've changed over time, and that you know, certainly has an impact on your work. The other part of it is that society has changed, that the country has changed in so many ways. What impact has that had?
Well, I think, you know, one thing I'm noticing is that we're much more comfortable with what used to be called dark humor. You know, there's South Park and The Simpsons. And so I've noticed when I first was publishing in the 90s, the standard response was, oh, my God, it's so dark. Are you okay? You know, and now I think people have kind of understood, quote unquote, darkness as just a starting point. You know, you start, you write a story or have a movie in a dystopian setting. It doesn't mean that the writer thinks the world is a dystopia. It's just a starting place. So, you know, the Wizard of Oz started in Oz. It doesn't mean that the person thought the world was Oz. So, although actually I guess it started in Kansas. But anyway, so if you start a story with a dark or kind of slightly negative offset, that doesn't really mean that you think the world is that way. So I think people are more comfortable with that because of the TV shows that are popular now and so on. So I felt a little more freedom to start with the dark concept and feel that people wouldn't just walk away from it, maybe.
It's almost that people have come to kind of an understanding or an acceptance, I suppose, that absurdity, that craziness in the world is the normal condition in many respects.
Exactly. And isn't it really? You know, when you think about when you go out into the world, you step out of your house, there's all this perception that comes in. And in our time, it's so various. You know, there's everything from great natural beauty to Hooters. You know, it's all out there. And in that, I would say that in that second before we start labeling things, that's the absurd world, where you have these crazy juxtapositions of things and people and so on. That world is quite absurd. Then to manage it, we start saying, oh, it's not absurd. This is my street. This is a mall. This is, you know. But so I think fiction kind of sometimes can aspire to getting us back to that instant when the world is fresh and new and isn't quite as reducible as we would like it to be. And that, for me, that kind of is, that's what absurdity is all about, too.
Mm-hmm. One of the things you look at is certainly the underbelly of class and capitalism. That's something that has profoundly changed, I suppose, in terms of our attitudes in the country since your last work.
Yes. I mean, suddenly it's in our face a lot more than it was. I just have always been interested in that almost as a structural thing, you know, that when I was a young writer, I noticed that most stories took place either in a non-work environment or in the gap between, you know, between when work was done. And in my life, it was reversed. I mean, most of my life was work. And then whatever emotional things I had to do was after everything closed down. And if you had a crisis or you had a, whatever you had, it had to fit in, you know, around your work schedule. And that was true when I was a kid. And so it seemed to me kind of a fun leap to start putting that structurally into stories where if a person has a job, then you need to show him there, you know, at least 50% of the time.
Also, you come to it from the point of view of somebody that has had a lot of kind of menial jobs, a lot of 8-hour a day jobs that you did long before you were a writer.
Yeah, I did a lot. I knew and kind of more than I wanted to. And so I love that Terry Eagleton line about, you know, capitalism plunders the sensuality of the body. And there was about a 7 or 8 year stretch there where I was just getting that lesson, you know, every day. So that does work its way in. I think, you know, in our country, scarcity, but even for those of us who aren't overtly, poor, there's the pressure of the wolf at the door and the fact that the system that we're making is not exactly merciful. So the people who are at the bottom, they really pay, obviously. But I would say even the people in the middle and towards the top, we're all paying, because if the system is fundamentally merciless, then everyone feels it. You know, if you and I are really hungry and we go to a restaurant and all the food comes to me, well, that's bad for you, of course, but it's not so great for me either. You know, I have to eat with this feeling of guilt and with you glaring at me. So I felt that, you know, the democratic capitalism won a long time ago. It won in the 80s. And now we're in this process of trying to decide what kind of capitalism are we exactly. And there's a range, you know, and if we err on the side of being a kind of merciless, winner-take-all capitalism in which the people who have really think that they got it by pure virtue and are therefore allowed or privileged to simply enjoy, that's going to be very bad for everybody. Whereas if we can soften up and say, well, yeah, we have a capitalism that seems to work, but let's make it a nice one. Let's make it a merciful one that is, in my mind, it's sort of Emersonian. So mm-hmm. We say the only point of this thing is to bring people up, you know, to everyone have a nice life and to make more citizens. And a citizen is somebody who is empowered and dignified and educated and feels powerful. If that's not the intention, I don't really, personally, I don't really see what the point is.
In many ways, that makes work a kind of political process, a political act in and of itself. Mm.
Yes. And I think it is, because when you go to work, you're a certain person. When you come home, you're different. And if your feeling is that you've earned a living wage and you haven't been beaten up too badly and that you're doing that work for a good cause, which is your family, and that there's I heard Bill Clinton one time say that the mark of a functional society is when your efforts and the results are logically related. So his example is you go to the sink and you turn on hot water comes out, you feel good. And I think, too, if you go to work, and no matter how menial the job is or how hard, if you feel that the results of that job are proportional to the effort, if it's helping you become a good father, good husband, then it's wonderful. That's kind of the ideal state. But I have the feeling that in our time, there are people working so hard and the results are so off, you know, off the effort, that it feels like a kind of dysfunction in the society. And on the other end, you have people who are not working so hard at all and thriving. And I think that's just sort of an unhappy state for everybody. That's just my sort of personal instinct. But those menial jobs inform that for sure.
It's interesting. I mean, you're from Chicago, and it sort of reminds me, as you talk about that, of Studs Terkel, who so many years ago kind of got to the heart of that in his work.
He sure did. He sure did. He was a great writer. I think I think of that as kind of a very Chicago ethos, because a lot of the best intellectuals I ever knew were people who were factory workers, people who worked and somehow were able to make that jump, as you said earlier, between the personal and the political. So they'd go to work, they saw their friends losing fingers at American Can or whatever, and they would understand that wasn't just bad luck, it was also part of a political reality too.
George Saunders, his new collection of stories, the 10th of December. It is just out from Random House. George, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Oh, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.